Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be marking the feast of the patron saint of statesmen, St. Thomas More, and adding John Fisher to the picture with our popular Latin lover. But first, here in Rome, a week-long international congress co-hosted by the Vatican Observatory took place this week at the foot of the Alban Hills, just south of Rome. Let's recall how this year the International Astronomical Union and UNESCO, the United Nations body that deals with education, science and culture, has called for a year especially dedicated to astronomy to mark four centuries since Galileo's celestial observations. Astronomy is an issue that the Vatican is particularly interested in, given that, as you probably already know, it has one of the oldest astronomical research institutions in the world, an observatory, once referred to as Specola. Astronomer and Jesuit Guy Consolamagno of this observatory was one of the speakers at this congress, which focused on the common ground for dialogue among cultures. Emma McCarthy sat down with him for a moment. Let's listen.
They've gathered together people from almost every continent to talk about how astronomy has affected their culture, how they are interacting as astronomers with their culture, and then how we can carry this further to recognize astronomy as, you know, well, to put it most simply, we're all in the same universe. We're all under the same sky. We're all made out of the same stardust.
There's a long history of a relationship between the Vatican and astronomers and astronomy. Would you like to fill them in on why astronomy is so important to the Vatican?
Well, the Vatican Observatory likes to trace itself back to the reform of the calendar in 1582. In some ways, we're even older than that because astronomy was one of the subjects that they taught in the medieval universities. But more specifically, as a current institute of the Vatican City-State, we date from 1891. And our first position was in the Tower of the Winds and on the walls of the Vatican itself. Then in the 1930s, we moved out to Castel Gandolfo and put some telescopes on the roof of the Pope's summer home and had some offices in the summer palace. Then in the 1980s, we built a new telescope in southern Arizona and some of our staff moved out there. This year, in order to have more room for the observatory and more freedom to be able to do what we need to do during the summer months when the Pope is also trying to use the summer palace for his work, we've separated ourselves and moved the quarters of the Jesuits and the staff offices to a completely refurbished convent in the Papal Gardens. We still have access to the telescopes that are on top of the roof, though, and we can still use them both for scientific purposes and for educational purposes.
You were listening there to astronomer, Jesuit Guy Consolamagno. Our thanks go to him and, of course, to Emma McCarthy. And now moving on in the broadcast. On the 22nd of June, the Catholic Church celebrates the feast day of the patron saint of statesmen, Thomas More, one of the most popular of historical figures of all time. Chancellor of England, he was born in London in 1478, beheaded on Tower Hill on the 6th of July 1535 for refusing to sign the Act of Succession, which repudiated the jurisdiction. More used all his brilliant knowledge of the law to avoid becoming a martyr. In a few moments, you can hear all this and more in a feature written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Stay tuned.
It is sometimes said that those who become martyrs receive a warning from God beforehand.
Of Thomas More, beheaded on Tower Hill in London in 1535, a story is recounted in the journal of his daughter, Margaret Roper, which suggests that he too had a presentiment of his tragic destiny. He was lying on the hay with his head on Margaret's lap. His eyes were shut.
Father, are you asleep?
Yes, and dreaming.
What are you dreaming of?
Of a far-off future day, Meg, when you and I will look back on this hour and this hayfield and my head in your lap.
Perhaps More thought he would become a martyr, but he certainly never sought martyrdom. He relinquished life most unwillingly, for he enjoyed it and asked no more than to be allowed to live in peace with his beloved family and many friends. This was not to be, and as More was a man of conscience, a man of integrity, and above all a man of prayer, he had no hesitation when forced to choose between God and man. He chose God.
Thomas More was born in Cheapside, London, in 1478. At the age of 12, he became a page in the household of Cardinal Morton, the king's chancellor, who recognized the boy's qualities and predicted a great future for him, though he could hardly have guessed that More, too, would become chancellor one day. After reading Greek at Oxford, Thomas was sent by his lawyer father to study law at Lincoln's Inn, and at 19, he was called to the bar.
Thomas became a brilliant lawyer, but he was also a scholar and the friend of scholars, and he entertained at his Chelsea home the greatest minds of Europe. He held advanced views on the education of women and inspired all his children, especially Meg, with his love of learning. A popular orator, a witty and merry person, his company was sought even by the king, Henry VIII, who made More his chancellor when Wolsey fell from power in 1529.
But More was an astute judge of men and had no illusions of where he stood with the king. He spoke of this to his son-in-law, William Roper.
I believe he doth as singularly favour me as any subject within his realm. Howbeit, son Roper, I may tell thee I have no cause to be proud thereof. For if my head could win him a castle in France, it should not fail to go.
More was not far from the truth, though it was not for a castle in France that he lost his head. In 1532, when Henry wanted to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn, More could not but oppose him. Moreover, Henry and his followers were passing bill after bill, abolishing papal rights and privileges, and confiscating church revenues. More resigned his chancellorship.
From that moment on, Thomas More was persecuted. He was essentially a public man, in words and actions, but in this, the greatest issue of his life, he was forced into silence and inactivity. Reduced to poverty, he hoped that by keeping silent, he would be left alone. But the confrontation came in 1534, when the Act of Succession was passed. In the preamble of the Act, the Pope's jurisdiction was repudiated. It was the point of no return. And More, together with Bishop John Fisher, refused to sign. He was committed to the Tower.
More had tried to prepare his family for his arrest by having someone knock on the door and call for him on several occasions. When the summons finally came, he allowed none but his son-in-law, Roper, to go with him. And to him he turned, saying, "Son Roper, I thank our Lord, the field is won." At the time, Roper did not understand More's meaning, that he had won his conflict with himself. No one, not even his family, could persuade him to change his mind. Friends of his who were members of the council did their best to shake his resolution in the hope of saving him. His wife and daughters were allowed to visit him for the same reason. Margaret, although she sympathized deeply with her father's position, did her utmost to get him to speak the formula which would set him free.
You want me to swear to the Act of Succession?
God more regards the thoughts of the heart than the words of the mouth. Or so you've always told me.
Yes.
Then say the words of the oath, and in your heart think otherwise.
What is an oath, then, but words we say to God?
That's very neat.
Do you mean it isn't true?
No, it's true.
Then it's a poor argument to call it neat, Meg. When a man takes an oath, Meg, he's holding his own self in his own hands, like water. And if he opens his fingers, then he needn't hope to find himself again. Some men aren't capable of this, but I'd be loath to think your father one of them.
So should I.
Then
there's something else I've been thinking.
Oh, Meg.
In any state that was half good, you would be raised up high, not here, for what you've done already.
All right.
It's not your fault the state's three-quarters bad.
No.
Then if you elect to suffer for it, you elect yourself a hero.
That's very neat. But look now, if we lived in a state where virtue was profitable, common sense would make us good, and greed would make us saintly, and we'd live like animals or angels in the happy land that needs no heroes. But since, in fact, we see that avarice, anger, envy, pride, sloth, lust, and stupidity commonly profit far beyond humility, chastity, fortitude, justice, and thought, and have to choose to be human at all, why then perhaps we must stand fast a little, even at the risk of being heroes.
But in reason, haven't you done as much as God can reasonably want?
Well, finally, it isn't a matter of reason. Finally, it's a matter of love.
Moore did not believe himself worthy of martyrdom, nor was he at all sure that he would be equal to it, should he be brought to the test.
Robert Bolt, who wrote A Man for All Seasons, from which this scene is taken, made this comment on Moore's stand.
He knew what area of himself he could yield to the encroachments of his enemies, and what to the encroachments of those he loved. But at length he was asked to retreat from that final area where he located his self. And there this supple, humorous, unassuming and sophisticated person set like metal, and could no more be budged than a cliff.
Thomas Moore did not condemn the many others who signed the act, nor encourage any to follow his example. All he would say of the oath was, "This I am sure, that of those that have sworn it, some of the best learned, before the oath was required, plainly affirmed the contrary of such things as they have now sworn."
To Margaret he confessed his fear of pain, telling her that he was almost afraid of a fillip, and that his flesh was by nature much more shrinking from pain and death than he thought it the part of a faithful Christian man. Knowing that he might be put to the rack, Moore took the precaution of writing to a friend that if it should be heard that he had taken the oath, people would realise that he had done so only in weakness, and not because he had changed his views. Over 400 years later, Cardinal Mincenti, in the same situation, did exactly the same thing.
Moore was in the Tower for 15 months, during which time he maintained his silence, despite constant efforts on the part of the King's men to extract a treasonable statement from him. It was Richard Rich, a former member of Moore's household and now Solicitor General, who finally provided the pretext for bringing Moore to trial. Rich, who was a notorious time server, falsely reported a conversation he had had with Moore in the Tower.
Rich asked Moore if he would take him as king, if Parliament so decreed, to which Moore replied yes, since that was good constitutional law. Then Rich asked, "But if there were an act of Parliament that the realm should take me for Pope, would you not then, Master Moore, take me for Pope?" To this, Moore offered a question of his own. "Suppose the Parliament should make a law that God should not be God, would you then, Master Rich, say that God were not God?"
And at this point, Rich reported Moore had added, "No more could the Parliament make the King supreme head of the Church." Moore never spoke these words, but Rich testified against him in the witness box, and on the perjurer's false testimony, Moore was convicted of high treason. Before sentence was passed, Moore was allowed to speak. He knew now that there was no redress, and broke his silence at last.
"To avoid this, I have taken every path my winding wits would find. Now that the court has determined to condemn me, God knoweth how, I will discharge my mind concerning my indictment and the king's title. The indictment is grounded in an act of Parliament which is directly repugnant to the law of God. The King in Parliament cannot bestow the supremacy of the Church because it is a spiritual supremacy. And more to this, the immunity of the Church is promised both in Magna Carta and the King's own coronation oath. I am the King's true subject, and pray for him and all the realm. I do none harm. I say none harm, I think none harm. And if this be not enough to keep a man alive, in good faith I long not to live.
I have, since I came into prison, been several times in such a case that I thought to die within the hour. And I thank our Lord I was never sorry for it, but rather sorry when it passed. And therefore my poor body is at the king's pleasure. Would God my death might do him some good.
On July 5th, Moore wrote to Margaret, sending her the hair shirt he had worn for 40 years and telling her he was to die the following day. The king, fearing Moore's eloquence, had sent word that he was to speak no more than a few words from the scaffold. So Moore told the crowds that when he first accepted office, the king himself had given him the most virtuous lesson that ever prince taught his servant, willing him first to look unto God and after God to him. This, Moore claimed, he had done, concluding, "I die the king's good servant, but God's first."
Moore's last words were in perfect keeping with his whole life and character. He jested with the lieutenant of the Tower, charged the executioner to strike straight, and pulled aside the beard he had grown in prison, saying jokingly that it had committed no treason.
Thomas Moore was beheaded on July the 6th, 1535, a few days after Bishop Fisher. According to custom, his head was impaled on a pike on London Bridge. But Margaret bribed someone to give it to her, and she preserved it all her life. It is buried with her in the Roper Vault in St. Dunstan's Church in Canterbury. His body was first buried in the Tower Chapel, and was probably transferred later to the tomb he had prepared in the church at Chelsea. During the London Blitz in the Second World War, the church was destroyed, but one thing was left intact, the tomb of Sir Thomas Moore.
Thomas Moore was a man who enjoyed living. As his friend Erasmus wrote, "There is nothing that occurs in human life from which he does not seek to extract some pleasure, although the matter may seem serious in itself." But when Moore was put to the test, he found something in himself without which life was valueless. His own act of self-validation turned out to be a martyrdom that he did his best to avoid, but that he had to accept if he was to see any coherence between the course of his life and its end. His death was not the headlong rush of a fanatical zealot into oblivion. It was the fearful, considered decision of a man of great self-knowledge, doing what he had to do, and wishing almost until the end that he did not have to do it.
You were listening there to a programme written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. My thanks go to both of them for this beautiful programme. And now, why not continue to focus on the figure of St. Thomas More by looking at a document from June 1930, at the time of the pontificate of Pius XI, one which brings into the picture the figure of John Fisher as well. I'd like to do this on a totally different note with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. You know what I found? I found something that maybe you're interested in.
John Fisher. Oh, Lord. That's another one.
West Monasterian, which means Westminster, I guess.
Yeah, West Monasteriensis.
The canonization of...
the Blessed Martyrs, Cardinal John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, and Thomas More, the Chancellor of England.
Okay, in Latin, I'm reading here. Canonizationis Beatorum Martyrum...
Cardinalis...
Johannes Fisher.
Episcopi Rofensis.
How Rofensis becomes Rochester, I don't know.
I don't know how they did it.
Maybe it was an
old Roman name. These are old Roman names.
Maybe Rochester was an old Roman.
Yeah, certainly.
And Thomas More, Tomae.
Tomae More. Cancellarii Angliae.
Why does it start with super dubio? Super doubt?
Yeah, this is, when they're asking a question.
So
and because the doubt is in the next line with these letters here. Whether a commission should be assigned of resuming the case at hand and for the effect about which we are talking. That's the doubt. Mm-hmm. Got it. Should we undertake once again the case of canonization of these people? And then he goes on, of course, he has to say, you know, yes, of course, but
this was before the founding of our radio station, because this
1930
happened in June 1930.
That's, I see.
The 18th of June 1930.
Very good. Wonderful.
So, inter beatos martyris Angliae, quae gloriosi titulo sanctorum insula appellabatur.
Ah, yeah. Okay, among the blessed martyrs of England, which used to be called the Island of the Saints, with a glorious title.
Was it called the Island of the Saints?
Oh, I don't know. That's what he says. You better look into it. That's not my kind of business. Two illustrious men shine forth like stars.
Stelle.
Stelle, certainly.
Refulgent. Due illustrus vire tamquam stelle
refulgent. Oh, is that good? Okay, among all the blessed martyrs of England, you see, one in the high degree of ecclesiastical hierarchy, because he was a bishop, and constituted in the Episcopal order, John Cardinal Fisher,
okay,
the Bishop of the People of Rochester.
Let's move down here. And I suppose Cardinal wrote this, no? Someone called Cardinal Laurenti.
Heaven's sakes.
But would this have been written in Latin by the cardinal's office, or would there be in those days? You would have been out of a job.
I mean, we do these things every day.
Do you?
These are flunkies, you know, secretaries who do this stuff.
You're a flunky. You describe yourself as a flunky.
Well, yeah, I mean, we just blah, 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 blah.
What's a flunky in Latin?
Yeah. Oh, it's naquam. Naquam. A worthless guy is a flunky. It's naquam.
You know, it's a strange thing, because at Vatican Radio, we don't have a Latin program, but we have an Esperanto program.
Well, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You used to have a Latin program. Some Jesuit, and he, a Slovenian Jesuit, and then he died, and whatchamacallit, some other Jesuit said, nah, it's the end of Latin. Well, anyway.
At any rate, if you go down the page, it strikes me how they have a little bit of a biography of Thomas More.
Oh, certainly.
Who was born in London, Londini Natus,
anno 1480.
1480.
And educated in Oxford.
Oxoni.
Pius Oxonii Educatus. Educated in Oxford.
Why are there two I's on Oxonii?
Because it's what they call the locative. Oxonii in Oxford. Pious from his childhood, and so on and so on. Praebat fidelibus super abut Chelsea. He was taking the lead in front of all the faithful of his parish in Chelsea.
A man for all seasons.
Oh, yeah, that's certainly.
How do you say a man for all seasons?
Omnibus temporibus viraptus. Oh, I can say it better than that. You saw the movie and so on.
Yes.
And his daughters and Henry comes up there.
They speak about Henry VIII. If you
and
turn,
the daughters go out into the water and say, oh, salve me, Rex. And they address Henry VIII in Latin when he came up on his barge up to Chelsea.
How'd you say Henry VIII came up on his barge? Up,
bah, bah, bah.
Up the Thames, rather than to Chelsea.
Chelsea am venit vicula sua Henricus Rex.
In fact, in this,
beautiful.
In this text, if you turn that page and you go to the first paragraph, yeah, they speak about Henry VIII. Paolo post Rex Henricus
Octavus.
Octavus is in the Latin numerals, whereas I noticed that the birth of Thomas More, despite being in Latin, was not in Roman numerals.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. That's just the thing.
1480. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my Latin is, as you know, very limited, but I can see that his wife, Caterina, was irritas et sacrilegia.
No, be careful. No. Henry VIII, who, while his legitimate wife, Catherine, was still living, Tintoretto had tried invalid and sacrilegious marriage with Anna Bolena. Mm. You see the whole story there. Mm. When he had not been able to obtain the approval of his crime, nor of a divorce, nor of new matrimony, so on and so on, de facit, this is in line 5, he fell away from the Catholic religion and from obedience toward the Roman pontiff.
A religione cattolica et ab obedientia
erga Romanum pontificem defecit.
Et rebellionis vexillum
erexit. And he set up a flag of rebellion.
A flag.
Well, vexillum. A standard. Oh, it's glorious.
Sub.
Well, we write the same thing today.
Sub quo subditos subditos.
Subditos suos cum nefando et credeli sue religion vultus abusu militare coagit. Under which flag he forced subditos suos, his subjects, to fight with a unspeakable nefando, an unspeakable and cruel abusu, abuse of his royal power. Ooh, they're glorious.
They seem to dedicate more time to Thomas More than John Fisher.
Although, yeah, actually, Fisher was the most educated man around. Everyone knows that.
There's lots here in italics.
Well, these are all quotes. Mm. Well, that's very good and beautiful. Ooh, I have to save these things. I mean, I just kind of never thought of doing this. And that's why he says this doubt here at the end here.
Where?
Whether the commission should be revised. And he says, affirmative. Where is this? Affirmative.
If affirmative seo signanda.
Namely that a commission should be designated of the resumption of the case if it will have pleased His Holiness.
Well, why is that interesting?
I mean, so that was the end of the doubt. Should we reopen the case of canonization for these two guys? And of course, he says, yes, His Holiness considered this a good thing, and so forth and so on.
Who was Pope Pius
the 11th in 1930.
Heartfelt thanks there once again to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. He'll be back again at this same time next week. And that's all I have time for today. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.